seminar, water concentrations and bioavailability, how you can measure them, and why they influence contaminated sediment remediation. This is session 4, case studies, PSDs for organic contaminants. This webinar is sponsored by the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences Superfund Research Program and NARPM Presents, and was previously held as a course at the 2014 National Association for Remedial Project Managers, or NARPM, training program and meeting. My name is Charles Maurice. I'm the Superfund and Technology Liaison to EPA Region 5 in Chicago, and ORD. I'm with ORD, the Office of Science Policy. I'm also with the Region 5 and the Superfund office, Superfund division. I will be moderating this session. We will get started in a few moments. While we wait for others to log on, I would like to cover a few housekeeping items. Gene was going over some of them just a moment ago, but I will continue forward with some more. When you registered, you were directed to the seminar's specific URL, which is the front page of today's webinar. The front page of the webcast contains a short abstract of today's session. We have also included pictures and short bio sketches of the presenters. Please note that the presenters' email addresses are hotlinked on that page in case you have questions for them after today's presentation. For those of you joining us via the limited number of phone lines, your phone lines were automatically put on mute when you joined the call. We request that you keep your phone on mute for the seminar. We have a lot of time for questions and answers, at which point you are welcome to take your phone off mute and ask the question by pressing #6 to unmute your phone. After asking your question, please put your phone back on mute by pressing *6. Again, that's #6 to unmute and *6 to mute. This will greatly reduce the background noises that can disrupt the quality of the audio transmission. Also, please do not put us on hold. Many organizations have hold music or advertisements that can be very disruptive to the call. Again, keep us on mute. Do not put us on hold. By now, all of you should be joined into the Adobe Connect meeting room and should see a number of windows or pods within the room, which include the presentation materials. The introductory presentation should be visible. I will now move over to our housekeeping slide. If you have problems viewing the slides or shared content, you may click the full screen button in the upper right corner of the shared slide window to expand that content. To shrink it back down to normal size, simply press full screen again. If you experience other technical issues with Adobe Connect, you may be able to download a portion of the items that will be covered and follow along manually. Please note, we cannot confirm that all portions of a seminar will be available in this manner. The majority of our participants will be listening to the presentation audio online through Adobe Connect. If you have problems with the audio, please check your own PC speakers or headphones. If you are on the phone lines, you may need to turn off your computer speakers or the online audio to eliminate duplicate broadcasts. You may submit questions by using the question and answer pod you see in the lower right corner. You need not wait until the question and answer period to submit your questions. In fact, we encourage you to submit in advance of the question and answer session. Please note, questions will only be visible to the host. Other participants will not be able to view your questions. At the appropriate times for question and answer, the moderator will read the questions out loud to be answered by the presenters. If you experience technical difficulties with the audio stream, You may use the question answer pod to alert us to the technical difficulties you are encountering. Please include a telephone number where we can reach you, and we will try to help you troubleshoot your problem. You may also contact our technical support directly at 301-589-5318. Again, that number is 301-589-5318. At the end of the presentation, we will walk you through our related URLs pod, where we have assembled information that is directly applicable to today's topic. This will stay with the seminar indefinitely, so you can access it after the presentation. We typically place these seminars in an archive with the soundtrack. So in the near future, you will be able to access the slides and hear the presentations as they were given today. You will automatically receive an email once the archive is available. Associated with the related URLs pod is an online seminar feedback form. We ask that you consider filling out the online seminar feedback form. We do look at the comments as we continue to try to improve the content and delivery mechanisms. You can also request a confirmation email from the feedback page as a record for your participation in today's event. With that, we are ready to start the session. Once more, I would like to remind phone participants to keep your phones on mute. And again, do not put us on hold. Our first presenter today is Judy Wang. Ms. Judy Wang is a remedial project manager for the United States Environmental Protection Agency, Region 9 in San Francisco, California. She has over 20 years of experience in the environmental engineering regulation, including regulation of point and non-point source surface water discharges, wetland restorations, and remediation of munitions and sites with contaminated soils, groundwater, and sediments. She graduated from the University of California, Berkeley with a degree in chemical engineering and is a California registered professional engineer. Prior to 2006, she was with the San Francisco Bay Regional Water Quality Control Board. Currently, she is a remedial project manager for Fort ORD Superfund site and Palos Verdes Shelf Superfund site. And serves as EPA Region 9 Used Defense Site Coordinator. She is the recipient of the 2011 U.S. EPA Federal Facility Response Outstanding Achievement Award and the U.S. EPA Silver Medal for Superior Service in 2008. Ms. Wang?
Thank you, Chuck. Sorry, my last name is hard to pronounce, isn't it? Good morning, everybody. First, some disclaimers. I took over the Palos Verdes Shelf site from Carmen White about 2 years ago when she retired. Carmen initiated all the studies that we're going to discuss today. I may not have answers to all your questions, but I will do my best to answer them. This Palos Verdes Shelf Superfund site case study was written with the assumption that the audience already has basic understanding of the technical theories on passive sampling devices. Therefore, I will limit my talk today to the implementation, pros and cons, and lessons learned from an RPM's perspective. So let's get started. For this presentation, I will give a short summary of the site, discuss the passive sampling activities conducted at Palos Verdes Shelf, or PV Shelf, the results of the passive sampling activities, the advantages of passive sampling, the lessons learned, cycling of progress, and what we plan to do next. From 1947 to 1982, Montrose Chemical Corporation of California operated a DDT manufacturing plant in the area shown in orange. Right here. While it was operating, Montrose, along with other industrial operations, discharged their wastewater into the Los Angeles County Sanitation District sewers. As a result, DDTs and PCBs contaminated effluents were discharged through the sewer system and contaminated the Palos Verdes Shelf area with tons of DDTs and PCBs and made the fish in the area unsafe to eat. As part of Montrose Chemical Corporation site, Palos Verdes Shelf was listed as a Superfund site on October 4, 1989. Just to orient ourselves, this area over here is the ports of LA and Long Beach. For those of you who know Southern California, this is Santa Monica Bay. This is a picture of Palos Verdes Shelf, and yes, a dolphin did follow us when we go out on our deployment trip. It is a very beautiful area. Unfortunately for EPA, majority of the contaminated sediment ranges from 35 meters to 70 meters underwater. Contaminated sediment has been found as deep as 700 meters, which is about 2,300 feet, underwater on the slope of the continental shelf. The most contaminated sediments are found near the sanitation district outfalls along the 60-meter isobath. That is about 200 feet underwater, which is deeper than recreational diving range and created some interesting challenges with site investigation and remedy implementation. The study area is about 102 kilometers square or about 30 square miles. In 2009, EPA signed an interim record of decision for Palos Verdes Shelf, and I'll be referring to this as the IROD. The selected remedy has three components: continue and strengthen existing institutional controls program, monitor natural recovery, and installing a 300-acre clean sediment cap over the most contaminated sediment. Numerous studies have been conducted at PV Shelf in support of the remedy implementation, including a pilot capping study. Today, I will focus my discussion on the passive sampling studies. With the help of Rob Burgess at EPA ORD and Dr. Loretta Fernandez, we conducted the 2010 water column study and the 2011 sediment flux study. The objective of the 2010 study is to see if we can effectively measure water column contaminant concentration using passive sampling devices. In September 2010, we deployed passive sampling rigs at 12 locations for 32 days. Each rig is designed to measure contaminant concentration in three different depths. For each depth, we co-deploy solid phase microextraction, or SPEMI, fibers, and performance reference compound, or PRC, preloaded PE polyethylene strips. Here's a map of the sampling locations. The 12th station is the background station, which is not shown on the map. Here's a schematic of the sampling rig assembling. As you can see, it is simply a pre-measured rope with an anchor on one end and a buoy on the other, with passive samplers secured at predetermined distance. In this case, it is 5 meters from the sea bottom, which is here, 30 to 35 meters from surface and the ocean surface. This slide shows the SPEMI results for para-para DDE. The height of the bar indicates water column contaminant concentration. The black bar color indicates that it exceeded the water column human health ambient water quality criteria. Shading indicates sediment DDE concentration, with darker color indicating higher concentrations. As expected, water column DDE concentration is highest in the hotspot area, which is around BA7C and AC, and lower upcurrent here at BA9C and further away from the hotspot, such as BA3C. This slide shows the PE results for the para-para DDE. Like the previous slide, the bar shows the measured water column para-para DDE concentration. Black indicates exceedance of human health ambient water quality criteria. Gray indicates exceedance of both human health and aquatic life criteria. As with the previous slide, the color shading indicates sediment parapara DDE concentration. As you can see, there's a difference in the measured concentration between STEMI and PE. Unlike the previous slide, the PE results indicated that water column parapara DDE concentration is actually higher as you move downcurrent from the hotspot. This slide shows the PE results for the PCBs. Know that the water column sum to PCB concentration is highest at BA4C, which is here, downcurrent from the hotspot. This is consistent with the PE water column DDE results but create an interesting dilemma. Does this mean capping the hotspot will not result in lower water column concentration? I bet you're expecting the next slide to be the SPEMI sum of PCB concentration figures. Well, you'll be wrong. All SPEMI PCB congener concentrations are below detection limit. Therefore, I did not include a slide. The second passive sampling study we conducted is the 2011 sediment flux study. The objective is to investigate the effect of the pilot sand cap on the flux of the DDT and PCBs from the sediment, observe the concentrations of DDTs and PCBs in pore water as a function of depth, and compare the performances of different types of passive samplers. The flux platforms were deployed at 6 stations, including a background station. We used PRC preloaded SPEMI fibers and polyoxymethylene, or POM, MPE strips. We analyzed for our usual suite of DDT and DDT breakdown products and PCB congeners. The flux platforms were deployed for 44 days in July 2011. This map indicates the sampling locations. Oops, let me move the zero. Station SMBFA7 is off the chart here, is the background station. Station LD27, which is here, is where the pilot sand cap is located. 6C is the station closest to the pilot sand cap. AC here is the hot spot. This is the initial design of the flux platform. It is basically a rectangular frame with crossbars that is weighted down. On each crossbar, two frames are attached. The frame design is shown on the right-hand side of the slide here. One frame holds the PE strip, the other holds the POM strip. Here's what a picture of the final flux platform. The white PVC pipe and the orange float is part of the time release system that was installed later. The float is designed to pop out to the surface after 44 days. Here's a pretty picture of the Ocean Sentinel with the flux platform on board ready to deploy. And this is a view from an ROV taken by ROV during the pilot platform deployment. As you can see, the platform sat flat on the ocean bottom as expected. And this is what the platform looked like after 44 days in the water. You can clearly see the area of the frame above, this white area, and below the sediment, which is down here. Here and here, over on the side, is how the SPEMI fibers are secured to the rig at about 70 centimeters above sediment-water interface. Here's the result of parapara DDE using PE, polyethylene. The vertical axis over here represent depth in centimeters, and this is zero at the interface. The horizontal axis represent concentrations. Please note that the concentration scale changes as you move from station to station. The flux rate is indicated by these black numbers in the blue area. As you can see, with the exception of SMB's FA7, the background station, and LD27, the capping station, water column concentration increases as one approaches the sediment water interface, and the sediment concentration increases in general as one moves away from the sediment water interface. The interesting thing to note that is the flux rate at the pilot cap site is not noticeably different than the closest on cap station, which is 6C. In fact, it is identical to the flux rate at station 7C, which is the hotspot area. This slide shows the result for para-para DDE. It shows the same trend as DDE. Once again, the flux rate is not that different between LD27, the capping site, and 6C, the uncapped site. In fact, the flux rate is actually higher at the capped site than the uncapped site. This slide shows the result for para-para DDMU, which is a dechlorinated product of DDT. We still see the same trend as other DDT dechlorinate compounds. However, interestingly, the flux rate at the pilot capping site LD27 is much higher than at the uncapped site 6C. After some analysis, we believe the flux rate increase at LD27 is caused by resuspension and redeposition of the DDT contaminated sediment on top of the clean sediment cap. The sediment at the surface of the site was so fine that when the clean sand cap was installed by a clamshell dumping sand from considerable height, the contaminated sediment resuspended and redeposited after the cap was placed. This slide shows the results for PCB52. Same trend as DDE. However, in this case, the flux rate at the cap site is much lower than at adjacent sites. This is caused by the fact that the surface sediment has comparably low PCB concentrations. Therefore, the resuspension of the surface sediment did not expose more PCB contaminated sediment to the water column. So why do we choose to use passive samplers and what are the advantages? First, for water column sampling, it does not require the collection of large quantity of water per sample. A previous water sampling event requires the collection of 99 liters of water for each sample. It must have been quite a challenge to keep a boat on location in a turbulent ocean to collect so much water. Second, time and cost savings. It is much easier to deploy and retrieve sampling rigs than collecting large volume of water from each sampling location. Third, the data collected represents only the dissolved and bioavailable fraction of the contaminant of concern, which is exactly what we need for risk assessment. Fourth, passive samplers allows us to directly calculate a flux rate instead of estimating them. Fifth, they allow us to measure water column pollutant concentrations immediately above the sediment water interface, which gives us a more accurate picture of what is actually coming out of the sediment and bioaccumulates in the biota. Sixth, the flux study allows EPA to evaluate the feasibility of remedial options. The flux study indicated to us that a sediment cap constructed using clamshell placement might not be such a great idea at PV shelf. Lastly, if and when a clean sediment cap is placed at PV shelf, the passive sampling platform can be used to determine if the cap as designed and placed achieved the remedial action objective and help determine the effectiveness of the remedy. So what have we learned at PV shelf? One, there's a difference in media performance. Some material may take longer to reach equilibrium. It is important that APRC is preloaded on the passive sampling devices to enable calculation of actual dissolved concentrations even without reaching equilibrium. As noted earlier, we did not detect any PCB52 using SPINI in the 2010 study. This could be due to the fact that we did not deploy the SPINI fibers long enough and didn't reach equilibrium. PRCs would have avoided this speculation. to be aware of environmental conditions. Oh, she changed slide. Our 2010 water column passive deployment only recovered PE samples from 8 near-bottom stations and 2 mid-depth stations. I had an, oh my God, did the fish eat my homework moment when I learned that some of the samplers were missing. Quite a few oceans and fish apparently follow the rig deployment vessel, and their favorite food is the jellyfish. Guess what do PE samplers represent underwater? Jellyfish. This gave me quite a bit of heartburn until I realized that the sunfish wouldn't have eaten the aluminum wires. If the fish had been pecking away at the PE, we should still have the wires left. We have concluded that the aluminum wires used to secure the PE samplers simply broke. We shall consider the conditions these samplers will be subjected to and use a different type of wire. Also, in our new 2013 sampling event, we lost an entire sample rig and a few mid-column PE samplers. On paper, the selected sampling location looks great. In hindsight, the selected locations are either adjacent to Port of LA and Long Beach, close to shipping lanes, or fishing areas. It is most likely that a crab fisherman mistakenly took the rig, thinking it's a crab pot. So, where are we at PV Shelf? We suspended the cap design since the flux study seems to indicate that the capping might not be feasible, and sediment monitoring data indicated that post-capping IRA goals appear to have been achieved. Our sediment monitoring data indicates that natural attenuation is occurring and DDTs are dechlorinating. Our fish tissue analysis indicates that we have met the IRA fish tissue goals for DDTs. Sediment analysis data also indicated that we had achieved the IRA sediment objectives for PCBs, which is contrary to the fish tissue finding. We also know that we do not have enough information to determine if we are meeting the water column objectives. To sum up all these bullet points, we are confused and we need more data. Here's what we plan to, what we are doing currently to address the data gap. We collect a sediment cores from 69 locations and cut them into 2-centimeter slices. They will be analyzed for DDT-related compounds and 20 PCB congeners. We conducted additional passive water column sampling at 17 locations. Each location has passive samplers at minimum 3 depth. We're planning to collect more water samples in the near future as part of a high-resolution water column analysis pilot study. Theoretically, only 1 liter of water needed to be collected for each sample. If this is possible, it can be an additional way for EPA to cost-effectively collect water column samples. We did not forget about the fish. We are in the process of collecting samples of white croaker and barred sand bass. We will be analyzing skimmed off fillets to determine the current risk and try to find a correlation between sediment contamination and contaminant levels in fish tissue. Before I open up for questions, I would like to thank Dr. Loretta Fernandez, formerly a graduate student with MIT, now a professor at Northeastern University, for conducting the studies, Rob Burgess at ORD for introducing us to Loretta and providing technical support, Chili Ting and Joe Gawley from Sanitation Districts of Los Angeles for providing us with logistic support and reality checks, Dr. Keith Maruya and Southern California Coastal Water Research Project for lending us their expertise and equipment, and lastly, a big thanks to my contractor, Bob Linforce at Gilbain, for keeping me sane while running all the studies. With that, I can open up for questions.
Okay, before we, thank you very much, Judy. Before we start the next presentation, just like Judy indicated, she will entertain a few questions, and let's go to the phone lines first. If you would like to ask a question, please take your phone off mute by pressing #6, state your name and organization, and ask your question. You can remute your phone by pressing *6. So from the phone lines, do we have a question? Again, it's taking your phone off of mute by pressing #6. Okay, well, if people are gathering their thoughts, we can switch over to the online questions, and of which there are several. So we have a question. The person asks, what is the Clean Water Act status of the body of water list for DDT and PCBs?
It is considered impaired, and there is a TMDL.
Okay.
And for the audience, TMDO stands for total maximum daily load, which is a discharge allocation.
All right. And thank you. And by the way, if Judy or our second speaker doesn't answer a question to someone's satisfaction, you can always type in a follow-up question online or ask another question over the phone when your turn comes up again. Okay, so right now turning back to the phone lines. Does anyone like to ask a question? And again, I can go back online for another question. And this one, the person asks, why did you use method 1668 for PCB congeners, which could have given a better result in picograms per liter level? Did you compare the cost of using direct testing with method 1668 with SPEMI and PE sampling?
You know, I think this is one of those questions that I have to get the person's email address and send out the answer. Since, as I indicated, I was not within the original study design, I do not know the basis. Unless Rob is on the phone, Burgess from ORD, he might know the answer.
Rob, if you are, you're welcome to speak up. Otherwise, we have on several pieces of the information and on the website, we have Judy's email listed, so the questioner can follow up on that question if an answer is still desired. Okay. I want to give the phone lines another chance. So do you have someone on the phone line want to ask a question? Otherwise, I'll keep on going to the online questions because we do have several there, but I want to be fair and go back and forth. Okay, well, keep thinking about it, your questions, folks on the phone, and we have a question saying, why are you measuring only PCBs? 52 are not congeners or total. Why are you measuring only PCBs, 52, not other congeners, or total?
I believe in total we measure, I think somewhere in my slide, I think it's 27 PCB congeners. 52 was just one that where the result is much easier to see. If you're curious as to why we selected those particular PCB congeners, they are an interesting mixture of what was studied in previous studies before the site was listed and what OEHA in California needs to for their fish consumption warning listing. So that's how we end up with our mixed bag of PCB congeners.
That sounds reasonable. Okay, why don't we, I'll go ahead and ask another question from online. The person saw that the 2011 study was noted as published in ES&T? Was the 2010 study published too? If so, what are the details? And I'm thinking that this person is wanting the citation details so they can look it up.
Yeah, it is also on ES&T. It's also written by Dr. Fernandez. I am in the process of actually updating our website to put links directly to these papers. So if the questioner do a search for EPA and Palos Verde shelf, they should have direct access to the PV shelf cleanup site, and I will start linking and uploading all the studies.
Well, that sounds good. Okay, thank you, Judy. I'll go with another question we have online here, and then I'll go back, before going back to the phone. This questioner asks, what is the direction of current flow? How large of an area was the test cap?
You know, I don't know the size of the test cap off the top of my head. I could definitely send it to you. Direction of current flow changes, but predominantly from south to north near shore, but then it does change direction when you go further offshore.
Okay. Someone on the phone line would like to ask a question at this point? Go ahead and introduce yourself. If not, hearing nothing, I will continue on with online questions. This questioner says, fish tissue goals for PCBs were not met. Is it due to risk assessment that considered only dissolved concentration and not very fine sediments laden with PCBs?
Can you repeat that question again?
Sure. I'll try to clarify the wording a little bit too. I know it's attending these myself that it's sometimes hard to quickly type in what you're trying to say. And anyway, fish tissue goals for PCBs were not met. Is that due to the risk assessment only considered dissolved concentration and not very fine sediments laden with PCBs? So were only dissolved concentrations, or is that the reason for the discrepancy and the goals not being met?
No, we think the fish tissue goals are not being met. We analyzed the actual fish tissue. We think it's because there are other sources out there. This is just Judy's speculation because we do need to pull water column data from a much wider area. But the speculation is, I think there's a background load of PCB from past industrial operations that added to the amount coming out from PV shelf is kicking it over the remedial action goals.
Okay, and this next question here online sort of getting into these other areas that you're just other sources and stuff that you're just mentioned. The question is, in the flux studies, could the concentrations in the water column be caused by releases from nearby uncapped areas?
It is definitely possible. We have a lot of working theories. There is also, I briefly mentioned that some of the contaminated sediment can be found down on the continental shelf, which is so deep that we have no access to it. There's just no logical way to get to it. So that would not show up in the flux study, but that could contribute to the water column concentration. In terms of the flux study, if you look at a finer hotspot or concentration map, it is possible that there are other hotspots. We notice the contamination is kind of like raisins in raisin bran cereal. You have clean area, then you have a little area hotspot. It really depends on how the current flows.
Seems reasonable. Yeah. Okay.
We have a question. How many PCB congeners did they analyze in the STEMIs and PEs?
It should be the same amount, which is, I want to say 27. Is 27 or 29? Let me look for it really quickly. Oh, 43. I analyzed more than I thought. 43 PCB congeners.
Well, so it's always good to realize it was the other way. I mean, that you have more than what you thought.
Yeah, I have more than what I thought. Geez, no wonder it's so expensive.
You're just that good. Okay, so the next question is what is the approximate getting into cost here. What is the approximate cost of SMEMI for PCB congener analysis, 66 congeners, including preloading, prep, and analysis?
You know, I actually have to pull out the actual billing to tell you. It is not, it will take a little bit work to find it, but I can. Can you please have the
sure.
questioner send me an email?
Sure. And that seems like the reasonable thing to do.
Yeah, because it's a subcontract of a subcontract, I believe.
Right. And there's lots of numbers. And
yeah, I need to take out the overhead and all that.
Yeah. Okay. Let's see. How did you determine the time frame for sampler deployment?
I cannot speak to the two that's presented. The time was selected by Carmen, along with Rob and Loretta. If I have to guess, because that's the same logic we use in 2013, which is it's a month where the ocean is calm, where we have fairly high confidence that we can locate our target area.
Okay. I'll give the phone lines one more chance at Judy before we're going to be going back to our next presentation. So does anyone on the phone want to ask a question? Okay, well, I'll have about a minute before we should be moving on to the next presentation. So I'll read one more question from the online, and that is, could disturbance to the OLIS cap from the platform cause a localized bias to the calculated flux?
Maybe, but I don't think so, because the platform was lower rigor carefully to minimize the disturbance. Plus, there should be enough time for the platform set in water long enough. I think we should be able to eliminate any temporary disturbance.
Okay. Let's move on now to the second presentation, and again remind people who have asked questions or may have questions that you have a chance to contact Judy by email. Also, at the end, we'll give a little bit more time for both Rachel and Judy to be answering questions some more. So hang in there if you haven't gotten your question answered. And I know I also have some still listed online here, which hopefully we'll get a chance to get to most of the questions. But right now, for the moment, we'll move on to the second presentation, which is by Rachel Thompson. Ms. Rachel Thompson is a project manager in EPA Region 9. She holds a BS with distinction in civil engineering from Stanford University, as well as an MS in civil and environmental engineering from Stanford University. She is professionally licensed as a civil engineer in California. She has worked in EPA Superfund programs since 2009 on a variety of complex sites ranging from a drinking water aquifer polluted with solvents to an abandoned smelter and has earned a silver medal for superior service and other awards for work. She previously researched water-related topics in California, Hawaii, and Tanzania, and co-authored publications in Environmental Science and Technology, FEMS, Microbiology, Ecology, and Estuaries and Coasts. She is currently an associate in the San Francisco Federal Executive Board's Leadership Development Program and a member of the EPA Region 9 Response Support Corps. She has managed a contaminated sediment site for EPA since 2012, where she is conducting a feasibility study and will soon dive further into remedy selection and implementation. Outside of the office, she is an avid backpacker, cook, musician, and triathlete. So, Ms. Thompson?
Yes, good morning from San Francisco, everyone. It's actually Rochelle, not Rachel, but I understand since we are on the phone and not in person. I just want to first thank everyone for listening today. Hopefully you got to hear some of the earlier versions of the webinar that included some of the technical details about how passive samplers work. So as Judy mentioned, I'll be talking mostly about how we actually use them at my site. As Chuck mentioned, I'm a remedial project manager in EPA Region 9 out of San Francisco, and I'm currently the project manager for the United Hecathorn Superfund site, which is what I'll be talking about today. I took over the site in 2012 from Penny Reddy, who had started some of the passive sample work at the site, and then we implemented a new round in 2013. I was asked to present a case study on the passive sampler work, and so I'll start by explaining a little bit about the site background. I have preliminary results and conclusions, and then we'll discuss next steps. For reference, since I know we have people from all over the country listening in today, the site is located in Richmond, California, which is near San Francisco and is on the Inner Richmond Harbor, which is an inlet of San Francisco Bay. It's actually in Contra Costa County in the East Bay, but it's definitely in the larger San Francisco Bay area. And San Francisco Bay is actually the largest estuary on the Pacific coast of either North or South America, so it's definitely a very important resource. The site itself is about 5 acres of land and about 15 acres of marine sediment in the Richmond Harbor. This is a more zoomed in reference picture, and so that I could fit the map on the slide, note that north is actually to the left on this slide. The small box in the right-hand corner shows again the location if you're not familiar with California, but what I want to focus on today is the Lauritzen Channel, which is actually the location of the site. The Park Canal is adjacent, and the two are connected by the Santa Fe Channel, which then connects into the Inner Richmond Harbor. The United Hecathorn site is a Superfund site because of past industrial contamination. Decades ago, several companies formulated pesticides at the site, including DDT and Dieldrin, and contaminated the surrounding soils and sediment. I also should note that when I refer to DDT, or dichlorodiphenyl trichloroethane, I'm often referring to all the chlorinated pesticides at the site. There's both 4,4 prime and 2,4 prime isomers of DDT, along with related chemicals, including DDE and DDD. Dieldrin is also a contaminant of concern at the site, but for the sake of the slide, sometimes I just use DDT to reference all of that contamination. In the 1990s, EPA conducted a cleanup at the site. We removed over 3,000 cubic yards of soil, which in some cases was pure product, and capped the rest. EPA also dredged at the site. There were over 100,000 cubic yards of contaminated sediment that were removed. Since the remedy, EPA has been monitoring sediment, and we've also been looking at fish and mussels and water concentrations, and we've also completed 3 5-year reviews. Unfortunately, these 5-year reviews indicate that there is, again, significant contamination at the site. Currently, the upland cap is still intact and remains protective, and the contamination levels in the nearby waterways, so the Inner Richmond Harbor, the Santa Fe Channel, and the Park Canal have all decreased significantly, which is great. Where we still have a problem is actually in the Lauritzen Channel itself, which again is the part that's directly adjacent to where the industrial activity occurred. There is potentially a risk for fish-eating birds and mammals, or there's a potential risk for people if they eat fish from the Lauritzen Channel. The land adjacent to the channel is actually an active marine terminal, so access is limited. And there's also a no fishing advisory issued by the state of California for the Lauritsen Channel. The image on the right is actually the actual image that is posted on pilings throughout the site. The original record of decision included monitoring muscle tissue concentrations. Each color on this slide, and I know there's a lot of information on this slide, but I'll walk you through it. Each color is a monitoring location. So red is the head of the Lauritsen Channel, and orange is at the mouth of the channel. So those are essentially the areas that are most within the site boundary. The x-axis is time in years, back from approximately the time of the remedy in the 90s, where the vertical bar is, up until today in 2014. The vertical axis is concentration of DDT in micrograms per kilogram on a wet weight basis, so that's in the muscle tissue. And as you can see from the slide, initially there was a decreasing trend, but since then it has either increased or you might argue that there isn't really a trend at all. Along with sediment results that indicate that we still have contaminations well over 100,000 micrograms per kilogram, which for reference is well above the prior remedial goal of 590 micrograms per kilogram, it's clear that the cleanup of the site needs more work. To address these issues, we've been conducting a feasibility study for the past few years. To give you a sense of how the passive sampling work fits into the larger decision making, I'll just briefly summarize some of the other work that's been going on at the site as part of the FS. As part of a Tier 1 sediment study, EPA's contractors conducted a bathymetric survey that included both high-resolution multi-beam surveys and also side-scan sonar surveys. Basically, we scanned the channel bottom to characterize the present state of the sediment in the channel. The figure shows a small version of some of the results, and the colored areas are actually underwater, so the different colors indicate depth. The darker blue-green color is deeper areas, and the more orangey-yellow color indicates shallower areas. You can see that there's a deeper dredge channel on the eastern side of Lauritsen Channel. That is where one of the berths for the Levin Richmond Terminal Corporation is located. When we compared the 2012 scans to past surveys, we attempted to basically track how sediment depth is changing over time. In general, there's a net flow of sediment into the Lauritsen Channel, which makes sense since it's a channel with only one opening. The deeper areas tend to be collecting sediment, and the shallower areas tend to be eroding. The next step was conducting what we called a Tier 2 sediment study. This basically was a slightly more quantitative analysis of the sediment dynamics. We deployed platforms, on the bottom of the channel, and this picture on the bottom right here is one of those platforms. We used those to monitor turbidity and also the speed of currents moving in and out of the channel. We also placed blocks of magnetic particles on the channel bottom, and this picture in the top left shows some of that work. We used magnets spread out around the edge of the channel to detect when the particles were moving, so we could see when the sediment at the bottom was disturbed and if it was disturbed, where it went. EPA also collected sediment cores and analyzed how easily the sediment could be eroded by running water over it at different speeds. The picture in the bottom left here shows the sed flume apparatus that was used for that work by one of our subcontractors, Sea Engineering in Santa Cruz. In general, this report concluded that vessel traffic regularly resuspends and redistributes sediment throughout the channel, and the detailed information in the report will be potentially helpful for actually designing the next phase of the remedy. Another effort EPA has completed at the site is a source identification study. Throughout 2013, we evaluated possible ongoing inputs of DDT and dieldrin at the site. We collected groundwater samples, which you can see some of that work in the bottom left. We also took tidal measurements from wells and tried to look at how the regional groundwater system is influenced by tides. We also collected embankment samples. The bottom right shows one of our grab sampling apparatus devices. And we also looked at pilings and seeps and basically anything that might have been missed the first time around. The picture in the top right shows some of what the area looks like at the edge of the channel. There's a mix of riprap and shotcrete and pilings that are still in use, as well as abandoned pilings. In general, we found that dredging residuals, including some of these embankment sediments that weren't removed the first time, are likely responsible for the majority of the contaminant mass. But there are still other sources of contamination that are still active and could potentially lead to recontamination if not controlled. The last technical report we worked on before the feasibility study is the DDT fate and transport study. And this is where the passive sampling comes in. You can think about the Tier 1 and the Tier 2 studies as basically the physics of sediment moving in the system. And this actually adds chemistry to the equation. In 2013, we collected sediment cores from many locations throughout the channel. And the picture in the bottom left shows a section of one of those cores. The Young Bay mud at the site tends to be very dark, very soft, and tends to be the most contaminated. There's also Old Bay mud beneath the Young Bay mud, but that tends to be much more consolidated. It's much stiffer, lighter in color, and for the most part, it's not contaminated. In addition to collecting sediment cores, we used passive samplers, which I'll talk about more in a minute. The picture on the top right, though, is a teaser for what some of our sampling setup was, including polyethylene samplers in metal frames being handed to a diaper. The specific goals of our passive sampling work were to investigate several questions, including where are the most problematic sediments from a bioavailability perspective, whether site contaminants are moving from the water column into the sediments or vice versa, from the sediments into the water column, and also could we use passive samplers for long-term monitoring. The picture in the bottom left is another picture of what the Young Bay mud looks like at the site, and the picture in the bottom right is an example of what the northern head of the channel looks like. That tends to be the location where we find some of the highest concentrations. In order to answer these questions, we used two types of polyethylene passive samplers. The polyethylene was solvent cleaned and then loaded with performance reference compounds, or PRCs. The samplers that we used in the sediment were mounted in a metal frame. The one in the top right is one of the ones that we inserted into the sediment. The frame is actually about 2 feet long, to give you a sense of the real life scale. The picture in the bottom right is an example of one of the sampling strips we deployed in the water column. It's simply polyethylene in a mesh bag to help protect it. And we also co-deployed with mussels. So I'm holding both a bag of mussels and the polyethylene strip. We deployed the PE samplers at about 10 locations in Lewiston Channel in 2013. Previous locations had also been used in 2012. So on the right, there's a lot of detail about historic building locations and things, but what you should look at is just the green and the purple dots, because those are our sampling locations. The picture on the left is where the water sampling locations were. You may notice that they're all at the edge of the channel. That's because we needed something to tie them to, and they needed to stay out of the way of the ships moving in and out of the channel. So we tried to get as much spatial coverage as we could, but we had to keep that limitation in mind. There's also one other background location that is not shown in either of these images. In September 2013, EPA and our contractors and the environmental response team actually deployed the samplers. At every site, we left a portion of the sediment sampler sticking out of the sediment bed so that we could measure the bottom water in addition to the pore water. At one of the locations, we put duplicate samplers, and the passive samplers for the water column, as I mentioned, we attached to a float so it would be able to stay underwater even as the tides moved, and deployed with mussels at various locations. Given the level of ship traffic in this area, we were actually thrilled that we then found all of these samplers a month later. We left the samplers in the environment for 28 days. That's partly because the mussels needed to stay out for 28 days, and we wanted to leave the passive samplers for about a month, so it seemed to make sense to use the same time frame for both. After the samplers were collected in October, we took them to our EPA Region 9 lab. We cleaned all the biofilms and sediment off, took photos, and then cut the samplers out of the frames and shipped them to MIT. Once back at MIT, the samplers were processed in the lab. And in case any of you aren't as familiar with what performance reference compounds are, I borrowed this slide from Phil Geschwend at MIT just to give you a reminder. Basically, performance reference compounds are loaded into the plastic before you put it in the environment, and then they slowly diffuse out while the chemicals you care about are slowly diffusing in. So there's no way of knowing exactly when the sampler is going to reach equilibrium. So after 28 days, it may or may not be at equilibrium. So if you use these PRCs, you have a much more educated sense of whether or not you're at equilibrium. And even if you haven't reached equilibrium, you can measure the losses of the PRCs and then back calculate what the concentration would have been at the end. The specific methods for how we loaded the polyethylene and then also how we analyzed it in the lab are available from Phil Geschwend. One of the citations is here on this slide, and I think I can actually provide both of the SOPs for both pre-deployment and post-deployment if you would like them. Before I move on to results, I want to just briefly share with you some of the challenges we faced. First, I want to ask if anyone remembers what happened in October 2013. The government shut down. The timing could not possibly have been worse because, as I mentioned, we had already put all of our samplers out in September, and we'd already coordinated a day with all of the ship terminal operators to pick them up in October. Ultimately, we were able to collect the samplers, but it required extra unexpected planning. I hope none of you will ever have to deal with that issue, but there are a couple of things I want to point out that are helpful for planning fieldwork. In terms of fieldwork challenges, the first challenge was simply boat logistics. When you have a dive team, they are in dry suits so that they're not exposed to the contamination, but there have to be various steps of decontamination, and they also simply have a lot of equipment. So we ended up using two different boats so that the dive team had enough space to safely conduct their operations, and then we had a separate boat that stayed clean that had samplers and the rest of the sampling team. The other challenge we faced at the site was visibility. Because of the mud being so soft and also getting kicked up so frequently by the boats, there's always poor visibility, and sometimes there's actually zero visibility. So we had to design sampling plans so that the divers could successfully insert and retrieve the samplers, potentially blind. What we used is shown in the bottom left. We essentially used tag lines, which are weighted cord. The divers would go to a specific piling. There's pilings all up and down the site, so we numbered them so we could track which one was which. And then we had pre-measured tag lines, so the diver could take the tag line out directly perpendicular from a specific piling and then use that to insert the sampler into the sediment. We did have some trouble with the lines tangling, however, so I would not recommend using as narrow of a cord as we did. I would use something thicker or potentially use different weights to weight it down. The other challenge we faced was simply boat logistics. The picture in the top right is one of the large barges that comes in and out of the channel on a regular basis. We were in constant communication with the various operators in the area, but we still occasionally had to get out of the water because it's obviously not safe for divers to be anywhere near any of these boats, whether they're stationary or moving. Once the passive samplers were analyzed in the lab, the first thing we looked at was the vertical information they provide. Since polyethylene is easy to cut, you can actually cut strips out of the sampler and analyze different depths separately. So the top section that was left exposed in the water can give you a measure of the bottom water, and then the other depths can provide different information. We didn't see much of a vertical gradient. It seemed like either the sediment was pretty well mixed or there were just similar concentrations in the vertical depth. One thing I do want to point out on this slide, though, is that we did look at multiple chemicals, and DDD actually was dominant in the system. If you look at the scale on the top of the left graph, it's almost an order of magnitude higher than the scale on the top of the right graph. So DDD, in this case, is much more common on the system than either DDT or DDE, although all are present. The next step for us was mapping out the locations of the contamination using the samplers. The northern head of the channel was the most contaminated. We generally saw pore water concentrations above 1,000 nanograms per liter. The second section was generally between 100 to 1,000 nanograms per liter. Moving one section further south, it was about 10 to 100. And then the more southern section was about 10 nanograms per liter. For reference, the background site, in this case in 2013, was 0.4. And I think it's always been less than 1. This map shows an approximation of the channel with some of the results laid out. The blue numbers are the bottom water concentration, so that's the number we got from the small part that was sticking out. And the brown numbers are the pore water numbers at the surface in the sediment. In general, as I mentioned, the higher contamination is on the northern area, so there's definitely a strong gradient down the channel. And we also saw that at every channel station, the pore water was often greater than the bottom water. So that means that we think there are fluxes of contaminants from the sediments actually into the water column and not vice versa. MIT also used some of these results to create a very simple mass balance. I'm not going to go through all the detailed calculations since I think they would be very tedious to look at on PowerPoint slides, but the full calculations are shown in the appendix of the Phaeton Transport Study, and that's available on our website. In general, what MIT did is you can assume that if diffusion from the sediments into the overloading water column is the only source of DDT and that tidal flushing is the only sink, you can use the four sections I talked about earlier and think of them as separate boxes. Then if you model the tide coming in and then the diffusion occurring and then assume everything is well mixed, you can then have the tide go back out, have diffusion adjust again, and repeat this process over and over again in an Excel spreadsheet. You can then calculate hypothetical steady state water column concentrations and then compare those to what you actually see in the field. So far, most of the results I've shown you were from the sediment-based samplers, but I also want to show that we did get useful results from the water column-based samplers. This slide shows on the bottom the water concentration inferred from mussels, which had traditionally been used for monitoring at the site. And the vertical axis shows water concentrations inferred from the polyethylene. The different colors are specific isomers of either DDT, DDD, or DDE. And the dotted black line is 1-to-1. So you can see there's actually a fairly good correlation. This is the 2012 data. And if I skip to the next slide, this is the 2013 data, which isn't quite as good, but definitely still there is a correlation. I also want to show you that the picture on the top right is what one of the samplers looks like after you've pulled it back out of the water. And it's important to remember that anything deployed in the water column is likely to be covered in biofilms by the time you pull it back. One interesting thing we noticed is that the mussels tend to overpredict what we actually see when we took grab samples from the water column. Now, this is not necessarily a direct comparison because the water samples were grab samples, whereas both mussels and polyethylene are essentially time average samples over the 28 days. There also could potentially be other effects because mussels potentially ingest sediment in addition to water, especially in a really turbid environment, so they could be getting extra body burden from other sources. In general, though, it seems that passive samplers are definitely very helpful for looking at trends and could potentially be used for long-term monitoring, although if we needed specific quantitative results, especially if we were trying to calculate water calculations, we definitely would need to do more work. On this chart here, just in case you didn't figure it out already, the water samples are the blue bars, the polyethylene inferred water concentrations are red, and then the mussel inferred concentrations are green. I guess another thing that could be affecting the results is that all of these calculations involve several steps. You have to make assumptions about the lipid content. You have to make assumptions about correlation coefficients. And so all of those could be factoring into the differences as well. In general, the passive sampler work was one useful line of evidence in the site investigation that definitely helped in addition to all the other data that we were collecting. We saw that definitely not only were the sediment concentrations highest in the northern end of the channel, but also the pore water concentrations are highest, so that definitely needs to be addressed in the future remedy. There's also a high degree of uncertainty in the mass balance modeling I was talking about, but there could potentially be an ongoing source mid-channel, and that matches some of our sampling results that showed some pretty high grab samples from the eastern shoreline. And we think we could also potentially use passive samplers for long-term monitoring at the site. The bullet here is specifically water column passive samplers, because those are the ones that we are specifically comparing to mussels, but you could potentially use either sediment-based passive samplers or water column passive samplers. The picture at the right shows some of the abandoned pilings that made it hard to dredge the first time around and also potentially make it difficult to sample some of the areas. Before I move on to questions, I just want to talk a little bit about next steps. All of this data is available in technical reports on our website, but then it's also getting wrapped into a larger feasibility study report. We then plan on proposing a remedy in what EPA calls a proposed plan, and then we hope to have a new record of decision with an amended remedy for the site. Our main contractor for this work was Sagetum Hill, so I definitely want to thank both Brenda McConaughey and Patricia White and several other people who worked with me there. E2 was one of our subcontractors, and Tamara Frank helped significantly with the field work. Our EPA Region 9 lab provided the boats for the work, and Andy Linkoff kindly drove the boats for us. The ERT dive team did a fantastic job, and Steve Blaze, Alan Humphrey, Scott Grossman, Chris Gow, and John McBurney at various times were either deploying or recovering the samplers for us. MIT obviously did a bulk of the laboratory analytical work. Phil Geschwind and Patricia Tatrick are the contacts there. Sea Engineering was a subcontractor to Hill as well, and they did most of the Tier 2 sediment work. Craig Jones is the main contact there. And I also just wanted to thank the Army Corps of Engineers, because we worked with Carl Gustafson and Earl Hader. If you'd like more information about the site or would like to look at any of those reports in detail, especially I know some of the figures are much better when you can zoom in and see much more closely what the information you're looking at, everything is available on the website, which is shown here. There's a technical document section if you scroll down. That is where most of those are posted. And if you have any trouble, definitely please contact me. My contact information is listed here. And I would, of course, be happy to take questions. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much, Rochelle. And I apologize for mispronouncing your name at the start.
No problem.
So let's try the phone lines first. If someone on the phone line would like to ask a question, please take your phone off mute by pressing #6. If you want to, you can state your name and organization and ask your question. And then we'll switch back and forth between the phone lines and the online. So. Anyone on the phone have a question?
Hi, this is Dion Lewis calling from AECOM with a question regarding the passive samplers. My question is, is there any information on how the biofilms, whether they inhibit any of the compound diffusion in or out of the passive samplers?
Yeah, that is an excellent question. And for the sediment-based samplers, there actually isn't much of a biofilm that develops. It's only for the part that is actually exposed to the water. I'm not sure if Matt Lambert or one of the other presenters from the earlier seminars is available to potentially answer that, since I don't immediately know the answer.
Or even someone who knows the answer. who hasn't spoken yet, I suppose would be good, but I'm not hearing anyone, so I guess we'll have to hold on to that.
Yeah, I can definitely speak with some of my colleagues and get back to you.
Thank you.
Okay, so going to the online questions, we have a question here that asking, have you had problems with fishermen ignoring the contaminated fish do not eat advisory?
As I mentioned, the Lauritzen Channel is actually a very active shipping terminal, and so there's Homeland Security requirements. So even when we go out to sample, they're always checking to make sure that we're actually EPA and that we're doing what we're saying we're doing. So I personally have not seen fishermen in the Lauritzen Channel when I've been out, although potentially I can't rule it out.
People can be
There are certainly fishing areas very close by that are actively used.
Okay, we have another question online here asking, it says that, did you say you used magnets to determine when sediments were stirred up? And this person is referring to slide 9.
Yes. I can definitely talk briefly a little bit more about the Tier 2 sediment study. The subcontractor was called ParTrack, and they actually designed sediments that were similar to what's naturally found in the channel, but then used biodegradable tracers that were both magnetic and fluorescent. So if you freeze blocks of those particles and then lower them to the bottom, when they melt, they spread out and form a patch on the sediment surface. And then as ships move over that patch, they can kick up the sediment, and then if you have magnets deployed around the site, because those sediments were slightly magnetic, they will actually attach to the magnets. So then you can analyze those in the lab and see when you're seeing sediment movement. We analyzed the magnets multiple times, both immediately after deployment and then for both days and weeks afterwards. All of that, if you're interested, is in the Tier 2 sediment study, which is on the website.
We have someone has raised their hand. Let's figure out that. Let's go to another question here online. When looking for on-site sources, did you place sediment traps in the stormwater outfall? When looking for ongoing sources, did you place sediment traps in the stormwater?
Some work has been done looking at the storm drain system. When we initially planned to put sediment traps, since we have been in a drought, there weren't any rain events. So that's something that we're still looking into.
Okay. Is the site still an active industrial site?
I think it depends on what you mean by the question. DDT and Dieldrin are not still being formulated at the site, but it's definitely still an industrial area. So there's other businesses that are now active on both the east-west side of the site, but it's not related to either DDT or Dieldrin. Does that answer the question?
I think it does, and if it doesn't satisfy the questioner, he can write another extension onto that on the question board. But in the interim, and in case it has been answered sufficiently, as a clarification, were you able to obtain a true pore water DDX concentration with the PSDs, or just a PSD DDX concentration? If you did get a true pore water DDX concentration, how did you get that from the PSD DDX concentrations?
We did not use any other sampling methods to calculate pore water concentrations. We only used our polyethylene. So all of our pore water measurements were calculated from the polyethylene.
Okay. Could the highest concentrations in the northern part of the channel be partially due to upland non-point stormwater sources? And this is from slide 25.
In general, the concentrations in the sediment in the storm drain are orders of magnitude lower than what's in the channel. So we don't think that the storm drain is a major source, although certainly we're still looking at all the possibilities as part of the feasibility study that we're working on.
most of the really high concentrations are actually in the embankments, either in the northern part, not in front of the storm drain, or along the eastern side.
Kim, the ration of PE interfered concentrations to the muscle concentrations be used to infer how much the muscle's exposure comes from suspended sediment?
I think if we're trying to do exact correlations, we probably need to do more work since we've only done this for 2 years now. Certainly, there's pretty good correlation between what's inferred from the polyethylene and what's from the muscles, but I think there's enough factors that I don't know that we could say conclusively that we could do that right now.
Okay. Again, I will return to the phone. If someone has a question on the phone. Again, remember to unmute your phone by pressing #6, and then you can go ahead and ask your question. We had someone raise his hand, and I lost him from the screen here, so I can't exactly get back to him, but perhaps he could just hit #6 on his phone and ask his question. Then we'll go on to the another online question. This person has says he has two questions. The first being, why was PE selected instead of the more robust POM? And the second question is, how was the biofouling removed from the sample?
For the first question, polyethylene was chosen before I began working on the site, but I'm not sure that MIT would agree that POM would be better than PE. So I can circle back with Phil to get a better answer to that question. In terms of removing the biofilms, you can basically just rinse it in the lab, and then there's a more formal process of rinsing in different solvents and blowing down the extracts to actually get the final. The specific methods are available in either the pre-deployment or the post-deployment SOPs, which I can definitely provide if they're not already available.
Okay. Someone asked the question, was the city outfall considered an outgoing source of contaminants, and had this outfall and feeding pipelines ever been sampled and or cleaned, flushed?
We definitely have sampled in the storm drain system, and as I mentioned, the concentrations there are orders of magnitude lower than what's coming from the channel, and the outfall is actually submerged at high tide, so some of the sediment is likely actually coming from the channel. We do plan on cleaning out the storm drain system as part of a future remedy.
Okay. Were the water column results that you reported a summary of multiple depths? Is there a best depth for passive sampling in the waters?
So the water column results we have are from one location. It was generally below the surface, but not at a specific depth. I think the depth that you're looking for depends on what you're looking for. I guess the one caveat is that we did collect the bottom water sample, so that's, again, the part of the sampler that was sticking out of the sediment. That specifically is useful information because that's the water that's right next to the sediment. So if diffusion is going to be occurring, it would be between the bottom water and the pore water. But the slides with the water column concentrations, those were grab samples taken relatively close to the surface at a single point in time. And the water column samplers were deployed again, on floats where they hung a little bit below the surface.
Okay. Well, at this point, what I would like to do is before we open up to question and answers from both presenters, I would like to make sure everyone is aware of the related URLs pod, which contains the seminar resources and feedback points. On the seminar resources page, we have assembled resources directly applicable to today's topic. This will stay with the seminar indefinitely, so you can access it after the presentation. We typically place these seminars in an archive with the soundtrack. So in the near future, you will be able to access the slides and hear the presentation as it was given today. Also in the related URLs pod, you will find an online seminar feedback form. We ask that you consider filling out the online feedback form. We do look at the comments and continue to try to improve the content and delivery mechanisms. Links to the seminar resources and the seminar feedback form can also be found on the last page of the presentation. I would like to remind participants of the various ways to stay connected to ensure you don't miss any webinars. For more information on EPA's CLUIN webinars, please refer to the CLUIN.org website, EPA Cleanup Tech Facebook page, follow EPA Cleanup Tech on Twitter, join the Cleanup Information Network LinkedIn group. For the latest Superfund research program risky learning information, please refer to the SRP Risk E-Learning, that's e-learning webpage, which is http://go.usa.gov/V=Victor, F=Frank, J=John, W=Walter. Or follow SRP Twitter feed at SRP_NIEHS. Okay, I will now open the questions and answer session to both presenters. If you have a question, please take your phone off mute. And if you wish to state your name and organization and ask your question. So now it's time for either speaker, and likewise, either speaker can join in answering questions, even if the question was not necessarily directed at them directly, but if it's a technical question that you have input on, you can comment as well. So on the phone, we'll try the phone lines first.
Hey, again, Chuck, I have one more follow-up answer. I just got a message from Matt Lambert. He says, yes, biofilms do make a difference in the uptake of passive samplers. When you use performance reference compounds, they take that into account, as do other methods for assessing whether you've reached equilibrium. He said that they generally recommend using PRCs.
Okay.
Does that help? If you have further questions, let us know.
Yeah, that sounds like it. Good. Thank you very much for following up on that. So do we have a question from the phone line? Again, #6 will open up your phone line, taking it off mute. If not, we have plenty of questions online, so we'll continue on with those. We have a question, and this is directed toward Rochelle, I believe. And the question is, how much did this investigation cost? What was the most expensive cost? Deep water? So they're wanting to know if the deep water was the most expensive, but how much was it? How much did the investigation cost?
Sure. Since there were so many different contracts, I will probably have to follow up with the questioner because we had many different costs from many different places. The site actually only has about 40 feet deep water at the mouth of the Ritson Channel. So if they're specifically worried about deep water, that might be more appropriate for the Palos Verdes Shelf, where, as Judy mentioned, it's orders of magnitude deeper since it's offshore. But I can certainly get more detailed cost information now that we've wrapped up most of the field work.
Okay.
Judy, did you have any further input on that or not?
Yeah, so it would be a little bit hard for me to give you the complete cost because EPA is lucky enough to have the cooperation and assistance from LA County Sanitation Districts, which means I get to use their boat for free, their crew for free, if they just happen not to be deployed to do their own work. So any cost I can provide would be skewed since it would not include the crew, the boat, the fuel, and all that.
Okay. Thank you. Another question is which among the PSD media worked best? Will you continue to use all three? And I believe this is to Rochelle.
I think that's actually for Judy since we only use PE at United Hackathon.
Okay, yes. Judy, thank you. Thank you, Rochelle.
For our 2013 deployment, we actually limited to PE and SPINI. PE seems to have been working really well for us, and it seems to be most flexible since we could use it to key into the sediment to measure pore water. So we're also considering another flux study. So we're actually going with both right now.
What analytical method did you use for PCB congeners? Was it high resolution method 1668?
So Chuck, I am looking at the crab and trying to pull it out. I thought that's what we used, but I need to confirm this. So I need to get back to the questioner.
Okay. That's fine. Dr. Wang provided a lot of information regarding slide 27, but the information was not on the slide. Can the notes for slide 27 be provided? And I'm not, maybe, I don't know, perhaps this questioner is asking this be posted to the resource page that that is associated with this webinar. Okay.
Okay. I definitely have the notes. If the questioners would like to send me an email, I could definitely copy and paste the notes. If not, the EPA PV shelf site also should have some summaries.
Right.
So Chuck, just to follow up on that, I have no objections of posting the notes. If it's the practice of the webinar to post the speaker's notes, that definitely works. It's just you have to live with my typos.
Yeah. Well, I think that you will have be a major decision maker in that, and you can speak with Justin as well afterwards to see what.
Okay.
What to do, and then get back to the questioner. Let's see. I'm trying to find questions without that are not, parts of ones that were asked before. Okay. Did the study design include PCB congeners by GC LRMS?
I assume that's for me.
I'm thinking so.
We're not looking at PCBs, so
right.
Coming in sort of mixed as well, so that adds another challenge. Okay, go ahead.
So yes, it's using GCMS. The reason I'm hesitating a little bit is that there are some variations For example, for water column, we're looking at high resolution TC, low resolution MS. I think actually that's for fish. So there's a little bit different flavor, for lack of a better word, to lower the detection limits. And that is something that we are currently investigating with our 2013-2014 sampling event.
Did marine growth visible on the above surface portion of samplers affect absorption of contaminants by the samplers? Were concentrations in the marine growth barnacles, for instance, measured?
No, I don't believe the project team specifically measured the marine growth, at least for PV shelf. Since PRC is used, we should have accounted for any effects from biofouling or growth.
We have a question. What are the cleanup goals? And I believe this one is for Rochelle.
We are actually in the process of developing new cleanup goals. The original goal in the 90s was 590 micrograms per kilogram of DDT in the sediment, and there was another number for dehydrogen that I don't remember off the top of my head. But as part of a new proposed plan, we'll be proposing new goals.
Okay. And again, I think this is for Rochelle. Just curious, why was MIT chosen to analyze the samples? Why not a lab that is closer to Region 9?
MIT had specialized experience in using polyethylene, and when I came onto the project, they had already done the 2012 sampling event. So for consistency, Hill was able to subcontract with them for the 2013 sampling event. There are definitely multiple labs that could be used as passive samplers are becoming more common.
How were you able to calculate a true pore water or surface water DDT concentration from the DDT concentration in the PE?
So I'm not sure exactly how much detail you want me to go into, but basically you use first the performance reference compounds to figure out how close to equilibrium you are, and then estimate what you would be at if you were equilibrium. And then you use various correlation coefficients, such as either a polyethylene water, so K-PEW coefficient, and also lipid water coefficients, to then actually perform the calculations. The details are kind of hard to explain verbally, but they're shown in the methods that I can share.
Okay.
So basically, you start with a concentration in plastic, so you have a certain amount of nanograms of DDT in a certain amount of grams of plastic, and then you convert that through a series of steps to an inferred water concentration. That's why it's called inferred, because it's not a direct measurement.
Okay, and then since dehydrogen is more soluble than DDT, did you see any differences in distributions or fluxes?
In general, DDT and dehydrogen have fairly similar nature and extent of contamination throughout the site, so the areas that are highest for DDT also tend to have the highest dehydrogen.
I believe this one is for Judy. Do you know what analytical method was used for the PCB congeners?
I've been looking through Loretta's paper, and it's actually quite interesting. It looks like Scorp used a method that's specific to them. SCORT stands for Southern California Coastal Water Research Project. It is a method using GCMS, but I don't believe it's a standard method.
Okay. Was a polymer barrier considered as a cap covered by a sediment cap to hold in place?
I assume this is for Palos Verde shelf?
Yes.
The answer is no, because deployment will be quite difficult. The feasibility study, I believe, looked at a fairly wide set, but mostly is the challenge is what can we do practically to put the cap down. Most of the hotspot is at about 200 feet underwater, so it's not quite practical to put a membrane.
A different person asks, were you comparing pore water concentrations when you spoke about exceeding the water quality level limits?
No, those were straight water column concentrations. That is just how the interim record decision was written.
Okay. And we have another question for you, Judy, is what was the rationale for using both PE and SEMI?
So originally, these were designed as study to see if it works, and if so, what works. That's why we've been carrying multiple different type of passive sampling media. The truth is, I personally, as project manager, thinks that we don't have enough data to say one is better than the other or which one has more valid results. From some of my slides, you can see the trends flip back and forth between SPME and PE. So at this point, we're carrying both just because we don't know, A, which one actually is more accurate, and B, well, actually just one, which one is more accurate.
This one I think is going to be for Rochelle. What will happen with the contaminants on the continental? No, wrong. This is again for
me. Okay.
For Judy. What will happen with the contaminants on the continental shelf since accessing it is not feasible?
Okay, I'll be serious about it. Usually I would just say pray, but or wait for a large storm. Seriously, there really isn't much we could do technically with existing technology. So the only saving grace at the site is that we do know we have the condition for the DDTs to naturally dechlorinate. And hopefully dechlorinate down to products that are not as toxic. So this truly would be a site that will need some sort of active remediation, institutional control, and monitor natural recovery.
Okay. I believe this one is for Rochelle. How close were the mussels to the samplers? Could the mussels have extracted enough DDTs to affect the amount of DDTs picked up by the passive samplers?
So we co-deployed the water column samplers and the mussels. They were essentially both in mesh bags that were tied together. Since the water is freely moving in the system, though, I don't think the fact that they were next to each other would impact one or the other.
What was the, and I think this is again for Rochelle, what was the average cost of the PE samplers?
Again, I'll have to get a more specific breakdown since some of our contracts were a fixed price lump sum, so I can figure out how much the actual samplers cost. Polyethylene in general, though, is basically painter's plastic, so the materials themselves are quite cheap. So the main costs are related to laboratory analysis and then also field deployment.
Then we have a question regarding slide 21 or referring to it. Inferred concentration, do you have a direct measurement of tissue concentrations from muscles?
Yes, we did collect muscle tissue concentrations. The one of the slides at the beginning that showed on a wet weight basis muscle tissue concentrations showed some of that data. The slide with the water column was calculated from the muscle tissue data. So depending upon what you're looking for, we can get you whatever version of the data you're interested in.
Okay. And again, you know, people listening in are welcome to contact the presenters for follow-up questions or deeper information. And certainly the speakers are not expected to answer questions off the top of their head sometimes that are fairly deep. But we have a question here of more general nature for Rochelle. It says, would creosote behave the same in the same manner as DDX in marine sediments?
You know, we haven't been looking at creosote since it's not a contaminant of concern at our site, so I'm not sure.
How often is the channel dredged for shipping purposes, and is the frequency considered in the study of sediments?
So the Lauritzen channel actually has not been dredged since the original remedy in the 90s, which did include dredging. So the deep area on the eastern side is still left from both previous dredging and also the fact that large ships still regularly come into that area. Certainly we would consider any major change to the system, such as dredging, in our analysis, and future remedies could potentially include dredging. But currently, only areas further off the site, so Santa Fe Channel regularly has dredging done by either the Army Corps or by other local entities.
Okay, sort of a probably related question was, could the change in the downward trend 1998 to 2008 be due to less activity in the channel, industrial slowdown?
For the most part, I'm not sure that it's helpful to speculate on specific trends, but the site has been industrial the entire time, and the formulation of the pesticides themselves finished decades ago. So I don't think that specific trends now are related to changes at the site.
This questioner says, have you considered looking for samplers that reflect concentration of DDT picked up by mussels? The polyethylene samplers used seem to significantly underestimate that picked up by the mussels.
I think the question is probably asking about the fact that, yes, mussels tend to predict higher concentrations. I guess it depends on what you're actually looking for. If we care about the concentration in the water, then you might argue that mussels are actually over-predicting. But if you care about what's actually being uptaken by either benthic organisms or water organisms, then potentially you could use different methods. As I mentioned before, we did generally see a pretty good correlation between polyethylene and mussels, although they both were higher than what we saw from grab samples in the water column.
Okay. This question is for Judy. What will happen with the contaminants on the continental slope since accessing it is not feasible? Oh, you answered that, I think, already, Judy. Sorry. Sometimes people ask the same question. Do we have any, someone who have a question from the phone lines? We haven't gone back to the phones for a little while, so, and we're coming down to the end of our time here. So does anyone, again, it would be the #6 to unmute your phone line and go ahead and ask your question if anyone on the phone line has one. Okay, well, then we'll go back to online here. We have Rochelle. A question to Rochelle. It says, will the new cleanup goals be higher? What treatability studies are being suggested?
So unfortunately, since the feasibility study is not public yet, I can't talk about what the cleanup goals will be or what the alternatives that we're proposing will be, but certainly that report is expected within the next month or so, and then it'll be public, and then we can share it freely.
For the PCB hotspot, was a polymer barrier like an underwater landfill liner considered as a potential cap held in place by a subsequent sediment cap?
I think this one is for me, and is very similar to the, I think I answered a question that's very similar to it.
Similar, yes.
Yeah, I believe we looked at it very briefly, but it's just technically almost infeasible to, or impractical, I guess, to put a liner down at about 200 feet.
Right. Well, I think we're running in like as with this one, some repeats as I'm scanning through the list here. So, and we are coming down to the end. So, I direct the listeners to the email addresses on the seminar homepage if you want to follow up with additional perhaps nuances or completely different questions from what has been asked. And it's also linked on the SRP Risky Learning webpage. If you did submit an online question and we didn't get to it, then it'll be forwarded on to the presenters, or again, you can send them an email and ask them yourselves. I would like to thank our presenters, Judy Huang and Rochelle Thompson, for their time preparing and for sharing their presentations with us today. And that concludes today's presentation. Thank you for your participation. Thank you.